Welcome to Mic Drop Market Spaces today. Just as a reminder, before we begin, this material is presented solely for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be construed as a recommendation, solicitation, or an offer to buy or sell, long or short, any securities, commodities, or any related financial instruments. As always, please contact a licensed professional before making any investment or trading decisions. I'd also like to thank Complete Intelligence for being our sponsor this week. Complete Intelligence is a globally integrated proprietary forecasting platform for finance, and I'll put their details in the nest. And with that, I welcome our guests. First, but probably need no introduction, but first we have Grant Williams. Grant has logged over 35 years in finance. During that time, he's lived and worked in 7 major financial centers from London to Sydney, building the kind of network that many only dream about. His career in the Japanese equity market started in the mid-1980s before a 3-year posting to Tokyo, ensured he had a ringside seat as the twin bubbles in equities and real estate burst simultaneously.
Tracy, I'm really old. Stop this. There's a lot of stuff to get to. It's going to take you forever. I'm old and I've been around for a long, long time.
All right, we'll do that. He's currently a senior advisor to Matterhorn Asset Management in Switzerland and a portfolio and strategy advisor to Volps Investment Management in Singapore. He's also host of the Grant Williams podcast, along with several other podcasts. Next, we have Alex Gurevich. Alex is the founder and CIO of Hante Advisors, LLC, founded in 2016. Hante is a San Francisco-based discretionary global macro investment firm that focuses on long horizon thematic multi-asset class investing across developed and emerging markets. Prior, he ran global macro trading at JP Morgan Chase, and he is the author of the Wall Street Journal best-selling book, The Trades of March, and The Next Perfect Trade, as well as many science fiction and fantasy stories. And with that, we'll get started. So since you're both new to the spaces, how we do this, I like to do just rounds of questions so nobody's sitting there talking, not talking. And please feel free to, you know, jump on each other's comments if you have anything to add, because we can make this as roundtable of discussion as you guys want it to be. And with that, all that out of the way, finally, we'll start with Grant. So we have to talk about gold, obviously. We just saw a recent breakout, though we're kind of seeing a bit of a pullback right here from all-time highs, not surprisingly. You know, I know you made 2 real specific calls in gold, December of 2015 and December of 2023. So what kind of predicated, you know, your decisions on looking at this market, being that particularly since this market's been kind of sideways for years, and where do you think it's headed, and what do you think this is telling us about the markets? I know that's a lot.
Yeah, but, thanks, Tracy. Thanks for having me on, and Alex, thrilled to be on with you. I'm such a fanboy. I'll try and speak instead of just sitting here listening to what you have to say. Gold, yeah. I mean, the thing that propelled both of those to recommendations on my part was disgust, pure disgust and loathing, and not mine, but the general markets of gold at those times. You know, back in the end of 2015, gold was so unloved as a commodity, as a metal, and the gold mining stocks were not just unloved, but just outright hated. And you just looked at it, and you looked at the situation, and it just made sense that you were going to start to see some money flow into the precious metal sector. And it did. I mean, we had a really good pop for the next 6 months after that. And then, you know, normal service resumed and markets settled down and people can find much easier ways, I think, of making money, and certainly much more exciting ways of making money. Gold is really a kind of stay rich, slow scheme as opposed to a get rich quick scheme. And so when animal spirits are high, people tend not to want to look at it. And people that have bought it as a trade tend to sell it. And a similar situation unfolded at the tail end of last year, going into the beginning of this year. You know, everybody was bulled up on the Mag 7. Everyone was making money hand over fist. We saw, you know, crypto rally. We've seen all kinds of things that are really kind of sexy ways to make money fast. And that tends to not catch a gold tends to not catch many people's eyes in those situations. And we found ourselves again with particularly the mining stocks absolutely devoid of any love, any interest whatsoever. And it just felt that with the fiscal situation deteriorating, with the inflation situation deteriorating and very unclear, plus the geopolitical outbreaks of tensions in multiple kind of vectors right across the world, but more importantly, the fact that that central banks had turned into strong buyers of gold for the last 18 years, and we had the last two annual purchase figures come out from central banks, and they were the highest in 50-60 years. And central banks are important because they're largely price insensitive buyers. They're not looking to time it. They don't have a target price. They are just looking to diversify their assets. In this case, I suggest away from dollars and into alternatives, given the initial freezing and now it looks like confiscation of Russian sovereign assets. So that put a bid under gold that that I think is unlike anything we've seen for some time now. So to me, it just felt like we had a strong buy impulse. We had very low ownership, particularly in the West, and the part of the mining stocks themselves, just pure loathing of them, and no one had any interest. So that, to me, is a great setup for a run, and so far that's proved to be the way things have gone. I mean, we have had a pullback, and that doesn't surprise me at all. But I think the gold now has a tailwind behind it that will make 2000 a floor. Whereas it was a virtually impenetrable ceiling for a long time. We've almost forgotten about 2000 now. So I expect gold to continue higher this year. If we see more conflict, that's, I think, going to be good for gold. I'm never one to put price targets on it because I'm not a gold trader. You know, I've owned gold for 20 plus years and I've only ever added to it. And at some point, my mindset is that I will exchange that gold for something I want to own more rather than find some arbitrary price where I think it's gone too far. So that's basically what I think about it.
But do you think, a lot of people are saying this is all China. It doesn't seem to me this is all China. And also, if you kind of want to address that, and then, on this run up, we really haven't seen retail speculators jump on this market yet. You know, we're actually on the way up, we're seeing outflows in gold ETFs. So, are retail speculators going to jump on this market? And, when do we see that happen?
well, certainly, I mean, the beauty of it is I don't think they're gonna sell the market anymore because they're just not really involved, as you say, here in the West. I think people talk about this being a Chinese phenomenon. We've seen deliveries through the Shanghai Gold Exchange go through the roof. So people are assuming that China is the culprit, and people do think of it in those terms behind all this. But again, this is a pattern that's played out for many, many years. The difference in attitudes towards gold from Eastern and Western investors is pretty stark. It's a trading vehicle, it's a speculative vehicle over here in the West, and it's very much a reserve asset, a source of liquidity, and something with which to store your savings in the East. And they're very, very different mindsets. So I think it surprised a lot of people to see the GLD holdings going down as the price of gold went up. But really, I think that just speaks to the nature of the buying that we see in the West, which is price related. It's someone looking to buy the 1800 and looking for that 2000 print so they can sell it. That's just not the way gold is viewed largely in the East. There's a massive underpinning of people that don't trust fiat currencies, that don't trust their governments, and they want to hold their savings in gold. So it is interesting. It is notable. China has been actively increasing its reported gold holdings for a number of years now, steadily, as has Russia, as have a lot of the countries that are and have been historically at the whim of the US dollar, at the whim of the SWIFT system, and as of the last couple of years, at the whim of the US Treasury. And I think that's a meaningful change in attitudes because, and I've talked about this many times, as soon as those Russian assets were frozen, Every central bank in the world that holds dollar reserves, which is just about every single central bank in the world, as a matter of national security, had to think about a possible plan B. You know, what if the same thing happened to us? And yes, right now we are a staunch ally of the United States, and we have been for many, many years. But what if? And this is not the kind of risk that they can just sit back and say, ah, it'll be fine. They have to have a plan B, because this is a national security matter. These are sovereign reserve assets. So I think that has changed the picture significantly, and the buying you're seeing is coming from places outside the United States, not just on the retail side where investors look at it as a speculation, but on the institutional and the sovereign side, where they look at owning gold as a more of a necessity.
Well, can I jump in with a couple of comments, though?
Yes.
Sorry, Tracy, do you have a one of the things that Grant kind of said, like, I'm not a trader, I just hold gold as continuous portion of the portfolio, because my thought of gold is more as a trader, even though long horizon trader. So I like actually to buy it low, buy it cheap and sell it expensive, even if it's over the course of a decade, because precious metals have really, really long cycles. And I have two thoughts about gold. One of them plus, another of them not really minus, but I would like to point out, so I do have price targets, unlike Grant. And by the way, Grant, it's so great to be with you on a call. It's been so long since we talked. I have to say that, and thank you for inviting me here. So my price target on gold is 3,000 on the cycle, but my price target on platinum is also 3,000, which makes platinum is just much more attractive investment. And my price target on silver is 60, which is also much better return on capital than holding gold. So I will just throw that out in the system. But another thing, which is another argument, which I don't see many people making for gold, but for any precious metal in any way. I've been looking at, and I wonder, like, Tracy, it might be much more up your alley to tell me what your thoughts on this are. I was looking just yesterday, I was looking at financials of mining companies, gold mining companies. And I don't actually know, I don't generally do bottom-up analysis, but it appears to me on the surface of it that extraction costs have gone up a lot. And maybe like because of the labor costs, political issues or situations. So if extraction costs have gone up a lot, that in itself can set a $2,000 floor for gold that Grant is talking about. Granted, gold is not so much dependent on the flow. It's more like because if central banks decide to sell gold, it does not matter how much miners are producing. But as an incremental factor, is it true that actually much more expensive to mine gold these days over this last few years? And if that, would it be material for the price of gold? Any opinions on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only have prices gone up for the cost of mining, but the industry as a whole has suffered lack of capex for, you know, the last 7-8 years, very similar to what we have seen in the oil markets. And so that definitely, I think, holds true to your theory on gold having a floor at this point.
I'd just add to that, Alex, as well, that there have been no greater spendthrifts than junior mining companies. I mean, these guys have borrowed and spent and borrowed and spent, and the balance sheets of the entire gold mining industry was just in disarray for such a long time. They have been forced to clean that up. So the cost, let's just put it this way, the all-in sustaining cost of producing gold has not gone up in line with inflation these last couple of years, because they have managed to cut costs and they have managed to better shape. It's definitely a problem, you know, the costs have gone up, but I think they're in better shape than they perhaps would have been 3 or 4 years ago, as they have been, to Tracy's point, starved of capital and starved of capex.
Okay, thank you.
And then with that, we'll go over to Alex. I had the pleasure of being on Complete Intelligence podcast with you just a couple of months ago, and where you spoke about how we're headed into a highly deflationary environment. Can you, one, go over your thesis, and two, since we have seen an uptick in inflation over the last few months, have this changed your trajectory at all?
So First of all, I will say that I don't think I will be very much affected by 0.1 uptick or 0.1 downtick in inflation. To me, however, for me, the important thing is the time horizons of the certain things happening, because what I've been emphasizing for quite a while now is the time lag. I wrote this post almost a year ago. Well, not maybe like it was August 2023, which is called Real Rate Tsunami Hasn't Reached the Coast Yet. So for me, it's all about what will be the effect of the rising real rates on the economy. And notice how I phrase it, not what was the effect, not what is the effect, but what will be the effect. And I'm very convinced that it's too early to say. So my conviction is that there is cannot be any conviction more than anything. It is too early to say what is the effect of real rates on the economy. One of the interesting things I've observed that if you draw kind of real rates impact with the lag that it typically affects our economy, which is like 2 years, and the stock market, then what was interesting then in 2021 to 2023, where everybody was saying how amazing this, how stock market is doing, in fact, it was underperforming given how loose the monetary policy was. I think it is hard to really, going back, it's hard to even wrap your head around running average of negative 6-7% real interest rates for like 2 years. Like if we go back to that and think about this, it's just mind boggling. We had incredibly negative real interest rates for so long, and that was on top of very loose fiscal policy. So the fact that stock market is where it is, it's actually very conservative. The fact is inflation is where it is right now is very conservative and shows the ability to inflation to stabilize. Because first we had post-COVID inflation, then we had a feedback on that because the original negative real rates shock created by post-COVID inflation created further inflationary environment because people were just incentivized to do various inflationary things like stock up on inventories and expand their balance sheets. Because who wouldn't expand their balance sheets when real interest rates are negative 6%? Who wouldn't want to borrow in this situation, right? I mean, you would be insane not to build up your balance sheet. So when that was all happening, then second order inflationary effects started. Now, because of COVID unwind, the top line inflation came down, which created second order deflationary effects, and we had cooling down of inflation in the end of 2023. Now, I feel like right now this bullwhip stabilized, and now we have a chance to see, and now we, if you look at the average real rates over the last 2 years, that's kind of getting close to zero if you use CPI headline. So we are just beginning to go into the zone when we will see what positive real rates will do. And there could be some debate about that. My inclination is based on the experience and based on the fact that amount of debt currently outstanding in the world, that positive real rates on the dollar will not be really sustainable. And eventually they will kind of be self-accelerating because the inflation will be driven down further, not by anything we can see yet. Now, none of those effects are even visible yet. I think those effects should be arriving soon. Now, where the challenge to my view is that if those effects do not arrive at all by the end of 2024, we kind of see mini wobbles. We saw regional banking crisis. We saw some other wobbling numbers on markets. But unless we see some significant like weakening of unemployment by the end of this year, my thesis will start getting challenged because now you can start asking, okay, when are you going to see the effects? Now, my post in August kind of said that the most likely period for maximum deflationary impact based on historical lags would be second half of 2024. So I'm not saying that I'm going to stake my entire trading on the fact that it's going to happen on that specific time horizon. It's possible for it to extend further in time. But that will be the point at which you're going to have to start looking at challenges to your thesis. It's probably second half of 2024.
And do you see, you recently spoke about, and I quote, she said, the mother of all bull markets in treasuries is coming again, which I thought was fascinating. So I'd love if you could share your view on that with the audience.
Well, yeah, if the process, see, what was interesting, I said it, it's actually a little while ago, and I think it was right ahead of the original bank crisis. So we did have a little, like, mother of the bull markets woke up in March 2023, and then she just went back to sleep. So she still, like, she rubbed her eyes, she woke up, she opened her eyes and say, should I get up? You know how sometimes you get up and then just kind of, nah, I'm going to go sleep some more. So that's, I think, what happened to the mother of all bull markets. So the reason why it has been my thesis and it hasn't really changed is because when the process will start, it will be extremely self-reinforcing. If inflation will start coming down, and notice I'm saying if, because we don't know yet. We really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, people who say the economy withstood high real interest rates, in my opinion, are speaking prematurely and irresponsibly. But people who are saying that we are for sure heading into imminent recession, I think also a bit premature. We just really don't know, unfortunately, or fortunately, because that makes for interesting markets. But if we're going to have, as inflation stabilized, and it does not matter whether it's like 2.3, 2.4, 2.5% on core PCE, it's like it's stabilized on some levels which are neither catastrophically high nor catastrophically low. That's what you can see. And we went into this positive real rate environment. If these positive real rates will have an effect via constraining employment, constraining balance sheets, pushing for increased productivity, if it will have deflationary effect, and if that deflationary effect will not be negated by various geopolitical and political events and fiscal things, and typically real rates win, but if they win as they previously usually do, we're going to have even lower inflation. As inflation will get lower, real rates will go higher and push, and then the process will get out of the stable zone and inflation will start falling rapidly. And it is almost guaranteed in this environment that Fed will be behind this curve because all the indicators of this happening will be extremely lagging. And I think the dream of accommodative Fed is gone. And I think that was my thesis even last year. What I was saying last year is, I don't know when the Fed is going to start easing, but I'm almost certain that they will start easing too late. So they are not at all going to jump the gun with their easing. For example, if we see continuously relatively stably strong inflation numbers, they're not going to say we're going to ease anyway because we feel like we should. They've made it pretty clear. And I think that was clear from the very beginning that the idea that they're going to, like, on some kind of like autopilot start easing no matter what happens in the world, I think it's naive. They're going to start easing not when they choose to. They're going to start easing when they have to, and that will be way too late. So I was kind of saying that cute idea of, oh, the Fed is going to just throw those little, dainty 225 basis points cuts in 2024, I think this idea is preposterous on both ends. I think either they won't ease at all if they don't feel that they need to, or when they need to, they're going to have to ease much more. The idea that they're going to balance it out so precisely and walk the rope so precisely they can do a couple of cuts, it just very rarely happens in the past. I think they'll be too late. I think when they start cutting, they're going to have to go to zero again.
That's a scenario for sure, but agree that they are behind the curve most of the time. So since you brought up a recession, Grant, we've had one of the longest runs in the yield curve inversion without a recession. Is it going to be different this time, or is the inevitable, do you think, going to occur? I mean, can we get around this?
Yes, to both of those, I think, is the answer. Before I expand on that, Tracy, I'd just like to say to anybody listening to this who thinks of themselves as a trader in these markets, take those last 10 minutes from Alex and clip them out as an audio clip and listen to them every single night before you go to bed, because that was an absolute masterclass in how you have to think to try and navigate particularly periods where we are right now. Because the reality is, Is it inflation? Is it deflation? Who knows? You can make really, really strong cases for both. You know, and Alex has his view, but he's very clear that he's not stuck with that. And I think you have to be incredibly flexible right now. And just everything Alex said there in terms of his thought process, you could pay an awful lot of money to do that course over about 6 months and not get as much out of it as you will over that 10 minutes. So everybody listening who wants to be a trader should clip that out and just listen to it on repeat as they go to sleep and try and get it ingrained in your brains, because it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, you're now making me blush, which is not so easy.
No one can see you, Alex. It's all right. It's audio. Don't worry about it.
This will be uploaded to all podcast websites by this weekend.
Good.
So.
Good. That's invaluable stuff. And I think, to Alex's point about inflation or deflation, the recession is the same thing. You know, I mean, could we get one? Yes. Could we get a big one? Yes. Could we avoid one? It's possible. I think it's unlikely. And I think it might look like we're avoiding it for the time being, but I suspect it's pretty much baked in the cake. Now, the thing that's surprised me is just how long it's gone without really showing its head. The one thing we can be certain of is that the NBER, as they always do, will announce it retroactively. So we will be in a recession without realizing it. That's just the way these things work. And so, you know, you have to look for signs of this, and everyone's focusing on unemployment. Everyone's focusing on the economic data points, which are coming in hot and having to push back their estimates of when the Fed will when the Fed will be forced to cut. And, you know, I think this is perhaps the most important takeaway from what Alex was saying, in terms of everybody's expectations were 100% that the Fed were going to be forced to cut. And there was a strong chance that they wouldn't even be forced to cut, but they would want to cut just to keep the party going. And as we've gone through the last kind of 6 months, we've seen those forecasts get pushed back and back, and we've seen the probabilities of them not cutting go higher and higher. And we've started to see now the first signs of analysts forecasting that the next move is going to be higher. We've seen a similar situation in Australia over the last couple of days when their CPI numbers have come in hot. So we're in this period where I think it pays everybody to have a view about inflation versus deflation, about recession versus soft landing or no landing. I tend towards the opposite side to Alex. I tend towards the inflationary camp, but at the same time, I understand there are so many strong deflationary pressures that any one of them could upend that thesis. And I think you have to have your base case, but pay really, really close attention to the opposite case. And in most cases, be looking far more closely for signs that you're wrong than you're right. Because if you're going to be wrong, it could be a very painful lesson. So I think the recession is baked in the cake at this point. I have no idea when it will be called. But I look at corporate earnings, which are not great. I look at corporate bankruptcies, which are terrible. I look at personal bankruptcies, which are terrible. I look at credit card defaults, which are terrible. I look at the flood of commercial real estate trading hands at depressed levels, which is terrible. And I see plenty of signs that we could already be in a recession. The only thing that's not really screaming that at the moment is the stock market. And I think with perhaps very good reason, that the stock market has become disconnected from the economic reality. It used to be that the stock market was a reflection of the health of industry. It just isn't that anymore. You know, it's become much more a beast of its own making. It's become the object and the focus has been the stock prices rather than the businesses. And we see that at a C-suite level. We see, you know, CEOs managing the business for the stock price rather than trying to maintain their eye on the health of the business that they're running, and with good reasons. You know, Charlie Munger was right. Show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. And when you reward people with compensation that's tied directly to the stock price, that becomes the end, and the means to get that higher are fairly obvious. So at some point, I suspect people are going to start focusing on the underlying business. And I was always going to bring this up at some point. You know, I think Tesla is a perfect example of this. You know, if you look at the car business, suddenly over the last several months, we've seen people starting to look at it as a car business. And if you do that, it's a pretty poor looking car business right now. You know, we saw negative free cash flow in the results on Tuesday night for the first time in I'm not sure how many quarters. We've seen margins come down. We've seen inventories go up. We've seen all the signs, the classic signs of a deteriorating business, and the stock price has performed accordingly. And then, you know, last night on the conference call, we saw a lot of announcements, forward-looking as per usual, that have given the stock price an enormous fillip. And if you go back and you look at similar forecasts of things on the future, none of which have been delivered, you kind of understand how the game works. You know, you promise things that will get the stock price higher, and hope that people take their eye off the actual underpinnings of the business. And that has been the general way for corporates to carry on for the last number of years. And it's only increased as the stock market has gone higher and as their compensation has gone higher. So it's a very long-winded and rambling answer, Tracy, and go off the point of your original question. But I think it's important to understand that, you know, a recession tends to not be a stock market thing. It tends to be an economic and an industry thing. And no one's really looking at that. Most of the people are looking at the stock market. So I think it might catch a lot of people by surprise.
I actually have a couple of comments on what Grant said. Do you mind if I jump in?
Please.
Go for it.
So first of all, this is kind of also like an open-ended question for me. When you were mentioning various like signs of weakness in the economy, this is kind of the paradox which I personally cannot resolve, because I'm not an expert on, as I mentioned before, on bottom-up analysis. So I see a lot of similar things that Grant mentioned, bottom-up signs of weakness, like as such as credit card delinquencies, restaurant occupancies, and various corporate bankruptcies, all those things mentioned. I see them mentioned. But at the same time, all the top-down numbers, either mixed, I wouldn't say they're universally hot, but they're kind of either okay or strong. And employment is a good example. Another good example would be, not mentioning CPI, but like even some recovery in manufacturing numbers, some recovery kind of fairly stable, even though there was some wobble, but like none of the other like GDP numbers seem to be okay. Any kind of numbers like retail sales or durable good orders, they could wobble like some downside revisions, but nothing really catastrophic seems to be happening in the economy whenever you look at any top-down number. And to me, it's like, how is it? There are all sorts of theories you can build around this, and I know some of those. Why bottom-up it looks so bad, but top-down it looks so good? I don't actually know the answer to this. I wonder if there is any ideas about that. That's my first question.
Grant, do you think at all fiscal spending has anything to do with that? Would be my first question back.
Yeah, look, it's hard to tell. I think I'm in the same place as Alex is. You know, you look at these numbers, and they're incredibly confusing. And I think part of the problem is everybody is looking for confirmation of something. We're either looking to confirm that we think deflation is coming. We're looking to confirm inflation is coming. We're looking to confirm a recession or otherwise. And I was actually speaking to Felix Zulaf this morning, and had the same conversation with him, and he just said, "Look, we're in this period of transition, and so you know every sign you're seeing in both directions is early for one and late stage in the other, and we just have to somehow take a longer term view. If you try and take a short term view now, you're going to get thrown around like you're in a washing machine. But if you can take a longer term view and understand which of these signs, let's say we're moving from deflation into inflation, let's say that's the direction. Some of the signals are very late deflationary signals, and some of them are very early inflationary signals. And it's down to everybody to try and decipher them the best way they can, and decide which path is the future. As I said, you know, Alex makes a tremendous case for it being a deflationary future, and I can see that, and people like Lacey Hunt can see that. Who's been right for about 40 years on this. But I can see inflationary data. I can see geopolitical issues. I can see supply chain issues. I can see supply-related sovereign issues, i.e. the amount of resources that are controlled by, let's call them the Global South, that seems to be the new trendy name. There are all kinds of reasons to expect inflation in the future. And an escalation in any of the conflicts currently ongoing is going to be a significant tailwind to that. So, you know, that's my stance, is that I'm looking at inflation as the problem I'm going to have to deal with. I may have to get through some periods of deflation in the meantime, but I'm not trying to trade the swings backwards and forwards between the two, as I think Alex might be doing. It's a very, very different mindset. You know, I'm looking to think about what am I going to be facing 3 years down the pike. And I suspect it's more likely going to be inflation than deflation.
And, you know, if we look, how do we feel, and this is open to either one of you, is, you know, say, for instance, the Fed decides not to cut, which they probably don't need to. But, you know, we're close to an election. So does that mean, you know, we see even more crazed monkey fiscal spending from Congress, which is obviously some kind of an easing, right? Or the drawdown of the TGA account, which is also effectively easing, as well as, you know, for these wars that we're in that are costing a lot of money, but at the same time, there are a lot of people that the military industrial complex employs. So what do we see going into the election, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I'm just saying, like, it's hard for me to imagine. What I don't understand is why would there be a crazy spending going into election when we have divided Congress? So I'm not a political analyst, but I'm not seeing any kind of crazy spending into election. It seems divided Congress, if anything, the government is disincentivized to spend as it should. And the wars are definitely inflationary, but we already saw how hard it is to push any kind of war military spending or foreign aid through the Congress. It's like you have to jump through a lot of hoops to push the amounts of money, which are not really so huge, through. That's my impression of completely amateur political analyst. I don't see this effect pre-election. Now, after election, if you have unified government, then you will probably have to fasten the seatbelts. If we end up with unified government after election, then all sorts of things can happen.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think post the election, no matter who wins, if they get the kind of result that gives them the ability to spend, then I think that's absolutely right. I think they will spend with alacrity. I think the big question that a lot of people have been asking going into the election is about whether there's some kind of conspiracy on the part of the Fed to try and keep the Democrats in power. And so are they going to try and keep conditions as easy as possible for as long as possible and kind of lean on the monetary levers as opposed to the fiscal levers? Because to Alex's point, that's a lot more tricky. Amazingly, it's become a political question, and people take a stance on it depending on their political leanings. You know, if you're a Republican, you're almost duty bound to assume that the Fed are in the pocket of the Democrats and are going to juice the gas. And if you're a Democrat, you know, that's a nonsense conspiracy theory. We'll see is the simple answer. Who knows? But the political divide is getting wider, and everybody on both sides sees this as an absolutely essential and pivotal election. And so, you know, I just don't think it's wise to assume that people won't do anything they can to ensure that they get a result which they believe to be important. And it's, everybody believes this is a do or die election, just like the last one, but this time more so.
And then that was my next thing, was about the conspiracy theory about the Fed, but you answered that. So let's move this over to Japan. I know you started your career in Japan, Grant. So what are your thoughts on Japan right now, particularly not just with the stock market, but with the yen where it is right now? I mean, does the BOJ step in, and what is the pain threshold on that devaluation?
I think that's a really important question. And I don't know where the pain threshold is. I would be surprised if they let it go much further without intervening, but they've already tried to intervene very lightly a couple of times on its way to kind of 153, 154. They kind of put a couple of lines in the sand and made it clear where they were setting that line, and markets immediately backed off, but they've kind of come back and attacked it again and gone through it. So the Bank of Japan is in an interesting position, as is the country. And I think at the moment for Japan, it's really about, there are three components to Japan. One is the economy. One is the Bank of Japan. And with that, you have to kind of tie in the Ministry of Finance. And the other is the stock market. And I think you can be bullish the stock market without necessarily being bullish the economy. I think you can be bullish the certain parts of the stock market without being bullish on the yen. It's again in that place where there's an awful lot of cross currents. The one thing I know is that there are a lot more people willing to look at Japan again for the first time in really a couple of decades from outside the country. I mean, Japan focus funds have had to kind of deal with that the entire time, but now there are a lot of overseas investors starting to look at Japan again. And when they do, what they find is a very different corporate environment to that which they became familiar with when they last looked at Japan, most likely. Now, corporate Japan is in a much better state. The Nikkei's obviously run. It's finally broken its 1989 high again. So the valuations aren't as low as they were, but they're still low compared to a lot of places around the world, particularly the US. And there are world-class companies in Japan. The yen is kind of the X factor, and it's been very weak, which has obviously helped the Japanese as they've repatriated overseas profits. But that yen weakness is turning into something a headwind for a lot of people who are looking to invest in the country. Now, for me, the key part here is the change in policy of the Bank of Japan, and this intention to quote-unquote normalize interest rates. Now, it's tough to decipher what that means with regards to Japan. What are normal interest rates in Japan, where they've been, you know, it's zero or negative for 20 years? But I think the important thing is the intention that the Bank of Japan have said, now we need an excuse not to raise rates, rather than we are looking for a reason to raise them. And that's been the case for at least a decade, probably more. And you know, Bill Fekenstein and I have spoken about this on the Endgame a number of times. This idea that the Bank of Japan gradually starts to move rates higher from negative 10 basis points back to unchanged, back to zero, sorry. And then maybe, you know, they get to 10, 25. Can they get to 50? I don't think anybody expected the Fed would get north of 5% without breaking something. Can Japan get to 2 without breaking something? I would have said it would be tough until I saw what the Fed managed to do. And if Japan does get to 2% or 1% and just signals their intent of the direction they're going, particularly if that coincides with a topping in the US and rate cuts by the Fed, you know, it changes the picture dramatically. And it changes significantly large amounts of capital flows around the world. If the Japanese start repatriating their savings to Japan, it changes an awful lot in the underpinnings of the financial system, with the yen as the biggest carry trade currency. So Japan is something that most people have basically ignored for, you know, a decade, maybe more. It used to be an incredibly important country, currency, bond market, but those days are long gone, and stock market, and it just hasn't been. But I think eyes are going to turn back to Japan, and they're going to be forced to, because the kind of changes that are being attempted in monetary policy are significant and have significant ripple effects for other countries around the world. So for me, I think, and I've been bullish on the Japanese stock market for 12, 16 months now. It's had a hell of a run. It's still not expensive, but it's a stock picker's market again, which is great. You can actually find really good companies that are undervalued. And I think that is going to continue. I think we will see people rotating into Japanese equities. I think if we see a stabilizing of the yen, at the moment it looks like a one-way train to, you know, 160. If we see a stabilizing of that, or we see the Bank of Japan come out and make it clear that they are going to defend something, or we get some kind of whispers of some agreement where the yen is too weak and countries are going to get together and try and shore it up, I think that will change things significantly. So just like Alex was talking about inflation versus deflation, Japan is something that I think if you're interested in it and you're prepared to do the work, there's great opportunity there. But whatever happens in Japan, it's going to matter for stock market and capital flows right around the world.
And do you think, and since you brought up, you know, you could see other countries getting together to kind of intervene. I find it fascinating, just a couple of days ago, we had the Japanese finance minister meet with Yellen and the South Korean counterparts. And I, to talk about the yen. So do you see any significance in that meeting? And, you know, does Yellen push down the dollar to help Japan, essentially?
Well, there's always significance when you get a meeting like that. The question is, you know, what is it? And obviously, a weak yen doesn't help Korea, that's for sure. And so the Koreans would certainly like the yen to strengthen, I'm pretty sure. So you've got probably two out of those three people, the Japanese and the Koreans, who would like the yen to strengthen. Japanese, not too much, but they certainly like to stop the weakness. And then there's Janet Yellen. And, you know, she's got a pretty strong dollar to play with. They're looking, I think, to cut rates. They're looking for an excuse to cut rates. So, you know, we can all make our own judgments about what was said and what might be happening. But I think to assume that that three-way meeting wasn't significant would be a little lax.
And so Alex, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to ask if, please jump in. I'd love to hear your opinion on Japan as well.
Well, I'll honestly, first of all, I'm not an expert on Japan right now. Like, it's not like I don't really focus a lot of my positions in Japan. It used to be my focus. I caught the first big yen devaluation trade from somewhere like 75 to 125. Unfortunately, I didn't catch the second one very well because my views on dollar were like more mixed. And I was more thinking of being in a cycle like 2004, 2007, if you wind, rather than the cycle turned out to be very different, this post-COVID. I thought of it more like a post-September 11th cycle, and post-COVID cycle turned to be very different. So that's just a side note. But I don't know what people can do to really reverse the dollar train, first of all, the first thing I would mention, because we're in this situation, so I like to kind of game the scenarios where take one asset price as it is priced and see what happens to other asset prices, as opposed to impose my view on one asset price and then price other asset prices according to already the universe skewed my certain views. So let's look at the world in which we're priced right now, that there is not much easing by the Fed. Because that's what the forwards are saying. The forwards are not putting a lot of rates going down on the Fed. They basically say that US rates will stay where they are. Also, while quantitative tightening might be moderated, it's still going on. The fiscal expansion in the US keeps going on. What does it mean? It means we're not accommodating anything, but we're issuing more treasuries. Somebody has to buy them. So we need to get that. So not all of them will be bought domestically. Some of them will be bought by foreigners, which will supposedly drive capital account surplus. So we have to keep increasing current account deficit to be able to sell those treasuries to foreigners, which means that we're going to have the dollar will keep being driven further. Now, Japan cannot take all of it. So their side, not so much interested in like, right now, and investing in Japan and seeing what like yen being that weak means for the world. And remember, yen from 98 to now, you could say, oh, yen is just a little higher than it was in, like dollar yen is a little higher than it was at the peak of 98. But how much difference in inflation has been between dollar and yen? Yen is really, really cheap. And to Grant's point, Nikkei is very cheap for foreigners, even at these levels, when you factor in yen. But what does it mean for other currencies? I think it's just the pressure on RMB will be relentless in this environment. And I don't see any, they might have no need for catastrophic devaluation of Chinese currency, but why would they let Japan devalue so much and not devalue at least a little bit along with it. And that's what they seem to be doing. They seem to be, again, holding RMB steady is equivalent to devaluing it too, both from carry perspective and from a real exchange rate perspective. So I think the interesting effect is I don't think there is many tools to weaken the dollar unless you start accommodating. And I hold to my thesis that there is no accommodation. And in fact, expanding fiscal deficit, that just means selling more treasuries. That's not accommodating. That's actually bringing more money home in the form of selling securities to the foreign markets. So I don't really see much meaning to that until, like, I don't know what is actually going to be done. Yes, they can have intervention and gap it up and down and create a lot of currency volatility, but how do you stop the dollar train if in the environment in which US economy is outperforming and US rates are staying high? Now, when this environment changes, you can price in different outcomes, but right now I'm pricing outcomes based on current interest rate forwards, and those outcomes I think still positive for the dollar. I just don't think yen will take all, will have to continue taking all the brunt of it. Some of it's going to have to spill out into other currencies.
That makes sense. And then I want to touch on China as well. So, Alex, what are your thoughts on China here? Is this the start of kind of a great slowdown as their economy ages, or is this a temporary bump in the road, to speak? And, you know, will they export deflation? I mean, they're already talking about wanting to devalue the yuan. So how does this, if at all, factor into your deflationary thesis?
Well, I do think well, China is obviously, that could work both ways. On one point, so for example, even the trend towards decoupling from China on friend-shoring supplies, right? Friend-shoring supply chain, in one hand, it is inflationary because it could increase the cost of goods in the US. In another case, it's deflationary because it slows down China, incentivizes them to devalue their currency, and that creates a certain deflationary shockwave around the world. I don't really know very well which of those factors are more prevalent. That's why it's so hard to think of geopolitics as a defining factor for example, domestic inflation, because they can work both ways for US, for example. But I think I've always been in the camp, there are people who are very strong proponent, like very strong China detractors, and they say like China is going to go through crisis, Chinese currency is going to go through catastrophic devaluation. But even those people typically say, well, in the long run, Chinese story is positive. I am probably the most bearish on China in a secular sense. I don't think anybody is more bearish on China than I am as a country to invest in, as a prospects of its financial future, because I think it has none. That's more or less my view. I think that China is going through a very long cycle and it's in the process of economically self-destructing, but that process could take decades. So I don't think there is any kind of prospect of China being a dominant economic power in the world. I think we've been talking about this in Japan in the 80s, and China has gone exactly the same route. And there is a lot of Japanification happening there. Lots of construction that is all going to fall into disrepair, ghost buildings, build up economy that does not do anything, current account surplus, which leads to strong currency, but eventually currency devaluation happens anyway. And we're having even much deeply negative population growth, aging population, all those things are just kind of building up in China, I think, in spades. Much, it's kind of Japan in the 80s on steroids.
And Grant, your thoughts on China?
Yeah, I think Alex makes a great point. I think I try to simplify this stuff as best I can, and my view of China has always been that this has been for the last 15, 20 years a newly capitalist system. And everybody has kind of made the assumption that they're going to nail the landing first time round. And I just never thought that was possible. You know, China is going to go through in a compressed time frame all the difficulties that every newly capitalist society has gone through. And I never thought there was a chance they were going to stick that landing. We knew that it was going to be a difficult transition for them. It's a very difficult economy to manage. And along the way, you were always going to get new inputs that were going to be problematic. And now we have, you know, the geopolitical input, which is becoming problematic for them. So while I wouldn't put myself all the way over where Alex very clearly stands, I definitely think that China is going to face some significant challenges. And I doubt very much that they are going to pass all those challenges. They are going to be faced with things that they struggle to deal with. And then it's going to be a question of, okay, if you are a dictatorship, how do you deal with problems that we in the West would be forced to deal with through democratic means? And I don't think we know what that looks like. So as a place to invest, for me, as they enter this period of significant challenges, I'd be very, very wary of being invested in a country that is going to face problems and deal with them in a way that I'm wholly unfamiliar if I'm a Western investor. So I kind of lean in Alex's direction. I think over the long term, that view will have to evolve as we see how they deal with things. But for now, I certainly wouldn't want to be aggressively invested and have money tied up in Chinese assets.
How much pressure is that going to put on, you know, the rest of the planet? Or, you know, do we see another emerging market sort of take their place? Say, for instance, India, and I know they're similar in some cases, but very dissimilar in a lot of other cases. But, you know, the whole world is kind of dependent on China, particularly in the commodity space, growth.
I was just going to make the point. India's a fascinating comp because back in 1994, I was in London working for UBS trading India out of London. And in 1994, the narrative was, guess what? It's India's time. It's the, you know, second biggest country on earth, second most populous. They're getting things in order. It's time to invest heavily in India. And it made sense then as it makes sense now. I think it makes a little more sense now because they are almost 30 years. They've had 30 years more to try and get the house in order. They still face the same problems they faced in terms of bureaucracy and red tape, which has always been a massively limiting factor for India. So, you know, there's always a story. There's always a next thing. There's always a next place. There's always a next country. But those countries being able to take the place of China, not as the reality of China is, but as the reality of China has been in investors' minds, which is the most important thing, because it's that perception that has driven capital into China. It's that belief in what people can get in terms of investment terms. It's not the reality that's driven those flows. And as the reality of China changes and becomes more challenged, as Alex pointed out, that is going to cloud people from investing in India in the same way. So whilst I think India does have a shot finally at kind of realizing at least a good degree of its potential, I think it's very dangerous to say China's out, India's in, which is a very easy narrative for investment banks to sell to clients, but I don't necessarily believe that it's as simple as that.
Well, I would say that maybe not China's out, India's in, but maybe the combination of the rest of the world just evolving could take some of China's place. But yes, I would agree that probably it seems to me, I'm not an expert, but it seems to me that India is not ready yet to completely take China's place. It's not ready yet to like be one-for-one replacement. But maybe but I don't know if China has to be specifically replaced by one country. Like it's going to be replaced a little bit by India, a little bit by Vietnam, a little bit by Brazil, a little bit by Mexico, here and there, right?
That absolutely makes sense. And I agree. And some African nations as well. So, I think growth can still continue. I was just curious your opinion, because there's, you know, a lot of people ride everything on, you know, solely what China does, particularly when you're talking about commodities. Now, that said, we are coming up on the hour. I don't want to take too much of your time. So the final round is the same question for both of you. It's one, talk about something that you wanted to talk about that you felt was important that we didn't get a chance to discuss. I know we went over a lot and around the world, but if there's something really on your mind that you want to discuss, please discuss that. And or, you know, what should we as investors be particularly focused on, say, for the next 1 to 3 years? And we'll start with Grant.
For me, I think if you're going to be an investor for the next 1 to 3 years, the first thing you need to understand is, are you an investor or are you a trader? And there's a very distinct difference between the two. And whichever you are, you're going to have a very, very different mindset for these next 1 to 3 years. I think if you're a trader and you're a good trader and you recognize what you are going to have some phenomenal opportunities to make money, because I think we're going to see an awful lot of very short cycles occurring as these bigger cycles kind of overlap and fight for supremacy. So I think this is going to be a fantastic environment for traders if you know what you're doing. If you think you've been a trader over the last 15 years in markets that have essentially just gone up and it's been pretty straightforward, I think you need to be prepared that we're going into an environment that's going to be very, very difficult. And that's why I think what Alex said at the top of the conversation was so, so important to understand. That's the way you need to think going into this. So that's my first point would be that, is if you're an investor, then you need to be able to look 3 years out, because I think we're going to be in a minimum period of 3 years of tremendous volatility and tremendous back and forth. I suspect it might actually be more like 5 or 6 years of that. And if that's the case, then you really need to think about assets you want to own for the long term that are going to survive the next period of volatility. You know, I think this is another reason why gold is becoming popular again, because I think it's something that will, if not give you outsized returns, it will at least give you some kind of stability and protection for your purchasing power with what's to come. So that for me is the first thing everyone should do, is just look in the mirror, have an honest conversation and understand, are you a trader or a speculator? And if you know what you are, great, then there's a clear way forward. If you think you're a trader, again, listen to what Alex said. And if you don't think like that, if that isn't just ringing a lot of bells for you, if it's all new to you, then I think you need to be very, very careful in the next little period of time.
And Alex, for the same question, talk about something you wanted to talk about that we didn't get a chance to cover, and or what should we be looking at as investors, you know, over the next few years?
There's two things I want to say. One of them, I want to just emphasize one point on which Grant just touched very briefly, but I think it is very important for people to understand current markets, because there was a big shift that occurred post-COVID. And the shift is like decoupling, or if you wish, depackaging. We're very conditioned by hundreds of years to think that stock market goes up during expansions and thus goes down during recessions, that inflation goes up during expansions, goes down during recessions, and employment, all those things, employment, stock market, inflation, overall economic performance, were used to be thought of as concurrent, because liquidity cycles were just the same as business cycles. And I want to emphasize that it is not currently the case. Liquidity cycles and business cycles decoupled by introduction of very aggressive of monetary and fiscal policies. So we could have a very different liquidity cycle from business cycle. So don't get caught up in the fact, oh, we are in recession, stock market has to go down. Or conversely, economic number is good, stock market has to go up. Very different things can happen in the cycle. So you have to think about liquidity and economic performance separately. That's one subject. And there is a whole subject we didn't really touch on, but I just want to put it in mind of investors, is the energy. And I think the energy is very interesting, and I'm not going to be able to talk about this at any length. But it's very interesting given the rising demand for computational capacity and data center and data storage energy demands with this AI revolution, that the demands of energy, I expect them to rise in completely unprecedented manner in the next couple of decades. If you think of a long-term investor like Grant speaking about, the amount of energy that's going to be needed to fuel the AI revolution, it's not something, it's something of any chart we've ever seen in our lives.
And I would agree with that. 100% written about it many times. So I love ending on that note. That's a beautiful note since it's my sector. With that, again, thank you, gentlemen, so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I know our audience certainly appreciates it. This will be uploaded to all podcast websites by this weekend. So you'll be able to get it there. And with that, I hope everybody has a great day. Follow these gentlemen on Twitter. And with that, I will see everybody next Wednesday before FOMC. And have a great day, everyone. Thanks so much for attending.
Thank you for having us on. Thank you.
Yep. Great. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks, Alex. Great to see you.